Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to Puro Politics, the political podcast of the San Antonio Express News. My name is Gilbert Garcia, opinion writer and columnist, and I'm joined by
Metro editor Greg Jefferson.
Nancy Prayer Johnson, deputy editorial board editor.
And today we're going to talk a little bit about the stunning election results in NEISD over the weekend. We're also going to talk a little bit about what's been going on in college campuses, including some in Texas. But we're going to start with what's been the big news in Texas politics over the past week. On Friday, Congressman Henry Cuellar, who's based in Laredo, but whose district includes part of San Antonio, the east side of San Antonio, a little bit of downtown, including the Alamo. And he was indicted. He and his wife were both indicted, and you're looking at bribery charges, money laundering. It's a whole host of things involving an oil and gas company in Azerbaijan. I guess it's a nationally controlled oil
and
gas
company. National Oil.
And
like Pemex in Mexico.
Yeah. And also this indictments also involve a Mexican bank. Allegedly, he and his wife took in nearly $600,000. This is something we'd been wondering about for a couple of years. In 2022, when he was in the middle of a heated primary race with young progressive attorney Jessica Cisneros, who had almost beaten him in 2020 and was challenging him again in 2022 in the Democratic primary, right in the middle of that race. You had feds raiding his home and his campaign office in Laredo. He insisted that he was not the subject of any investigation. He won his election. Many of us have probably forgotten about it. Right. And we had this bombshell on Friday, Greg. What was your reaction?
I mean, it was the scope of it was shocking. If you read the 54-page indictment, I mean, if the allegations are ultimately proven to be true, he put a lot of work into this. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about like a whole series of shell companies involving his wife, kind of layered payments, going through, various middlemen, and ultimately him acting on behalf of foreign agents. In the case of the Azerbaijan government and a bank based in Mexico City. They both, if the allegations are true, both got services rendered. he took care of them in Congress.
Trying to get legislation or maybe amendments into bills, enlist his colleagues maybe to support them on certain things.
Yeah, that's right. And as far as Azerbaijan, I mean, he did that in part because he had a seat on the House Appropriations Committee, mm-hmm. which is a very powerful seat. And gives lawmakers sitting on it, considerable ability to change spending priorities and mess with legislation. Yeah.
One of the interesting things about this is that, as I mentioned, it was known as the primary race developed in 2022 that there had been this raid at his home, and. Then House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Jim Clyburn, who's a very powerful member of the House, got behind Henry Cuellar nonetheless. Jim Clyburn came down to San Antonio for a big rally on the east side before the runoff, which Henry Cuellar ended up winning. And I think it was clear that there was some risk involved because you had to look at that and think, it was really damning even at that point, I think.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for one thing, there were almost very few details, if any, kind of emerging from the feds, as you would expect. I mean, they're super professional and they're not going to leak a lot.
Yeah.
So for House Democrats, it was kind of a calculated risk. In retrospect, looked pretty dumb. But in the short term, You know, they were really afraid of this progressive insurgency they were seeing from the Quad, for example. And I think they didn't, you know, they were willing to hope for the best and know that the investigation wouldn't be concluded for a couple of years.
It's a Democratic seat, but there was some risk of losing it. And and they had a thin, Democrats had a thin House majority at the time, which they ended up losing as they were worried they were going to lose.
I think now they're probably, I mean, I would think that they're regretting that gamble. It was, it would have been better off to have Jessica in that place. You know, she was a strong candidate, progressive, strong candidate. And we are already seeing the signs of everything in the past. It's not like it's a big surprise right now. I mean, just not too long ago, he was getting an award in Laredo, of course. And he's done, you know, we cannot deny that he's done a lot of good for his community, for his hometown, for his district.
He's one of those bring home the bacon sort of members of Congress. And he always has been.
Very old school.
Absolutely. Yeah. The problem is, it seems that he's, you know, done it for himself too. And, you know, and nobody's above the law. And I feel like, I don't know. I mean, I know that it hasn't gone through, you know, and, you know, innocent until proven guilty. Sure. However, things are looking pretty bad, right? Yeah. And I just feel like maybe he got to this point where maybe he felt that he was above the law, like he could get away with it. Cause I just question, like, how? Like, how did he and his, I just, what was that conversation like? Like, we're going to get rid of this? Like, I just keep trying to picture, did they talk about it at the dinner table? Like, all right, now's the time we can get away with this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, why risk that? Why risk the office and all the good work
and that you do? And involve your children. I mean, none of the children were, I mean, they were not
indicted. They won't have penalty, right? Yeah.
Well, we don't know. I mean,
they're involved in the shell company.
That's right. They're unnamed, but it's relative one, relative two. But yeah, I mean, they were involved in the establishment of these shell companies. And, you know, one of them was involved in, you know, a conference call with Azerbaijani officials. That might have been the National Oil Company, but they were involved. And that was, you know, that was something that got started by their father.
Yeah.
I just worry about, you know, after the fallout, right? So then what's going to happen to his constituents and to, you know, the people that he has been representing and doing good work for, right? And, you know, what's the fallout going to be? It's going to be most likely they are not going to get the kind of results that they need. So.
Another aspect that was controversial about House leadership getting behind him, House Democratic leadership getting behind him in 2022, is the word was already getting out about the Supreme Court. Well, not about this, but the Supreme Court, there had been the leak about Roe v. Wade being overturned, and he was the one Democrat in the House who was anti-choice. And that, I think that was... that had been the subject of controversy with him and members of the party for a long time.
Isn't he the last moderate Democrat? Like, he... I believe one of the last, sure.
Definitely on that issue, he's, the lone member of the House who's not pro-choice. Yeah,
that's okay. Right. Yeah.
And as you were saying, Greg, you know, I mean, we'll have to see how this plays out, but they did a lot of work on this. You have text messages, you have bank records. Henry Cuellar has asserted his innocence, but he hasn't dealt with any of the specifics that are there. He hasn't denied any of the specifics. I think the tone of it was more like, this is kind of standard procedure for members of the House.
It was funny. Between the news breaking on NBC and the indictment, he comes out with a statement proclaiming his innocence, and he makes some kind of vague reference to, we checked it out. You know, I mean, like,
it's okay.
We went to the House Ethics Committee. We checked it out. It was something in that vein.
Yeah. And I have a hard time believing the House Ethics Committee would say, a bunch of shell companies. No problem. That's the way to handle this thing. Yeah. Just kind of funnel it through.
Very all you need to do is put as much distance between.
Have
services rendered and payment, and you're good.
Have person B give it to person.
That's right.
Person A give it to person B.
Yeah.
And even at the time, there were some suggestions from supporters of his that this was politically motivated, which never made any sense. If we're going to accept the idea that the Justice Department acts based on politics, which I think is the argument we hear from Donald Trump a lot, that Joe Biden, you know, if there's a federal indictment against Donald Trump, Joe Biden indicted me and so on.
Yeah.
But if we're going to accept that, you have a Democratic administration. You had a Democratic member of Congress who most pundits thought was the most likely to be able to win a general election at a time when the House was just, the Democrats were holding on for dear life when it came to their majority. And the timing of it was weird, but I see, it felt to me not like they timed it during a primary race because they wanted to go after him. It felt more like they probably reluctantly did it at that time because they're thinking he's been tipped off or something. Evidence is likely to be destroyed. Like, we have no choice but to go in because I don't think this is what they normally would want to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a situation where maybe we'll know more about this later, but I think that there was a fear that evidence was going to be tampered right. with or destroyed.
Yeah, totally makes sense.
I think it's super interesting to see just who's coming out and in favor of him, you know, and in support of him. And totally, I know, you know, former President Donald Trump actually
is defending
spoke up for yeah. him. Which
did not see that coming.
I think some people who don't pay attention too much are like, wait, what? Where? What party is he with? What's going on here?
Well, and one of the many examples of Trump over the years in his undisciplined way, just kind of really going against what should be the Republican message. The Republicans did not put up strong candidates. They have a runoff in the Republican primary, but they didn't put up a strong candidate this year. Cuellar didn't really face strong opposition in the Democratic primary because I think this case had kind of receded from the minds of a lot of people, and it was kind of accepted he's probably going to win again. But nonetheless, Republicans certainly want to help him. This is a chance. There is a chance now that Republicans could do something with this seat in November. And so you had the Republican Party coming out and say he needs to resign and so on. And then Trump comes out on Sunday and says, Henry Cuellar, this really respected, highly thought of congressman got attacked by Joe Biden. He's being targeted by him because he's strong on the border.
Respected Democrat congressman. He did say that.
Because he said that Biden wants to take him out because he's Cuellar is strong on the border, and Biden is for open borders.
And there are a bunch of D.C. thugs. Crooked Joe Biden is a threat to democracy. I mean, does it – what?
Is Cuellar happy to have that?
Like, yeah. Is Biden happy about this? I don't think Biden's happy about this.
No, I mean, I wonder if Trump read this very long indictment. No, probably not. He probably had to look up the correct spelling of Henry Cuellar. I mean, in this case, it's like so much else you've seen out of Donald Trump. There's no right or wrong.
Right. Yeah.
There's winning. There's losing. There are means, using people as means to score points.
Yeah.
And his point was, the open border policy of the Biden administration. And Henry just happened to be there and convenient.
And and Biden is going after me, and he's going after this guy too. So we're kind of going after his own now.
Yeah, kind of the same.
It's silly, and the sad thing is, people will probably believe that. People believe this. Like,
a really interesting person to watch as this goes forward is Colin Strother, who we all know, who's been a political operative in San Antonio for a long time, and worked on a lot of campaigns, a lot of local campaigns and legislative campaigns. But his big client over the years was Henry Cuellar. I mean, that was his bread and butter. And in all the years, I mean, I think I met Colin maybe 15, 16 years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there's anything that defined him, it was just his intense loyalty to Henry Cuellar. And to the point where he would get into social media fights with people if they criticized him or anything. And he would basically, there was a lot of bravado, like we're going to wipe the floor with, Jessica Cianos or whatever. And there was a lot of that. And right about the time that raid happened, he stopped working for him. He has not once publicly defended him. He's been very, very quiet on the issue. And we'll see what happens. But I think that was very telling because this is someone who, he was really kind of his mouthpiece in many ways.
He was. I mean, Colin Strother was interesting in that you never knew what exact position he had with Henry Cuellar. I mean, but you knew when you called him, you could get through to Henry, or you could, if you had some just question you wanted about, hey, what's his thinking on whatever, you knew you could call Colin. And, he would always facilitate an interview with a congressman or get you a comment, even though you don't, it's like, okay, he's kind of a spokesman, but what does that mean? I mean, he's not on staff, not on his congressional staff. He has, he's been involved in numerous Cuellar campaigns, but it was just kind of fuzzy. Yep. But yeah, I mean, Henry, he was, as you say, I mean, Colin Strother's bread and butter, and Colin does show up unnamed in the indictment as one of the entities that received these various payments, refers to a consulting firm in Buda. And that's, you know,
that's where it lives.
So, yeah. And I mean, we're going to see how this plays out, but I would not be surprised if he becomes a really important source for the feds in this, in this case.
Yeah, that's right. It's impossible to tell, you know, who's cooperating, who's not.
Right.
But we'll see.
We will see how that plays out eventually. Wanted to talk about, Northeast Independent School District in San Antonio, which is really, Nancy, I think has been kind of deadlocked for the past nearly a year. Terry Williams, a trustee, passed away last summer. Mm-hmm. And so you've had kind of a 3-3 deadlock between sort of conservatives who've talked about, you know, parent rights, parent choice. Yep. And basically they've been in more or less in favor of restricting books that are available there, injecting religion into school,
sex education,
fighting against that kind of stuff. I mean, it's very much been the idea has been to really bring sort of a culture war sort of mindset into the school board, and they've been kind of deadlocked with these three who I think are maybe more pragmatic about these kinds of things. Yeah. We had five races on the ballot on Saturday, and in all five cases, the conservatives lost. What was your reaction to that?
Relief. I mean, I actually was kind of looking at it like, I have to say I was a bit afraid.
And you had very low turnout, so it's hard to tell what to make when you don't have a lot of people showing up.
We expect that, right? Yeah. We know. I did see, you know, over the weekend, you know, people saying, and during the week, like voting just wasn't happening, which that's no surprise. We know that people are not going to come out and vote. So I was just very, I was just really afraid that things weren't going to go well, because when I say about going well, is like, do we really want it locked like that all the time? Do we really want this culture war there at the center of NEISD? Mm-hmm. You know, they have 57,000 students. They have big problems, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, every district does, but right now, Northeast ISD is facing a $39 million deficit. They have declining enrollment. So it's not the same district as maybe what we would have been talking about a few years ago. They really are facing some strong problems, and they can't be focused on these culture wars, right? And so when I saw that, you know, Lisa Thompson, Tracy Shelton, David Byer, the incumbent, mm-hmm. Melinda Cox, and Terry Chigney, that they all won their election. I mean, it was
some of them by big margins too.
Yes.
Like Byer, he was going up against a challenger, Jack Hoyle, who I think was kind of epitomizes. And he was in the MacArthur area, which is where I live, and I was getting inundated with texts from him, and he was talking about fighting the woke ideology.
Oh my God.
And it was, you know, there was kind of an anti-LGBTQ sort of vibe to a lot of this
stuff.
When
the candidates met with our board, they actually, with our editorial board, you know, as we meet with all the candidates, they really held back on that kind of stuff, I felt like, because they knew their audience. But that doesn't happen when they're in school board meetings.
That's
right. Really, the politics doesn't belong in school boards, but we know, obviously, it is. It's there. It gets in the way of the business of running a school district and all the needs that they face. Mm-hmm. And this just sets them up for more success. And, you know, you do have some detractors just saying, well, you know, it's like a rubber stamp, you know, and they're not doing their job, but they absolutely are. You know, they're doing the reading, they're reviewing the contracts, they're looking at, you know, how is the superintendent doing? You know,
these are the issues that the school board should be dealing with, really.
You know, we have to remind people that these are volunteer positions. They don't get paid for it, right? To be putting up with all the drama. You know, there's some that actually said, hey, we just don't want to deal with it anymore, right? And that's a sad, to want to serve students and to have that experience, and just to say, like, we don't want to deal with it, we don't want to do it anymore because of the politics. That's an indictment of what's happening in our politics, right? And I have to say that out of all the local elections, school board elections are the most fiery sometimes, the most controversial, and it's a shame. It really is.
It's intensely emotional stuff. And I mean, we saw when there were, I think the school district at least temporarily removed books from libraries. And I can't remember if this was last year or year before. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at people who showed up there, I mean, parents, students, even teachers in opposition to this. Yeah, it was very emotional stuff.
Yes. The sex ed stuff is a big deal as well. And you just think about any culture war out there, it's happening at the school board level and with even less guardrails, right?
Which to me, I mean, what was remarkable about this election was, yes, it was a low turnout election, but the two conservative PACs outspent the one supporting more moderate candidates 7-1. Mm-hmm. And like, isn't the religious right and social social conservatives, aren't they supposed to be more motivated and aren't they supposed to do better in low turnout elections?
That's the way
they got crushed. That to me says there's like maybe what we're seeing in this election is the limits of the parental rights movement.
Absolutely.
Like maybe they've hit a wall here.
That's it. Yeah.
And they've, right. you know, you have
course correction. They're just like, hey, it's gone too far.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, hey, do you want your school board to look like Congress? Do you want to, you know, do you want it to be, a snake pit that can't function, that can't operate as it should?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we've heard over the years, and it's hard to tell if it's still true because our politics, we're in a rough place with our politics at every level. Yeah. But you always hear that at the local level, that the closer you get, the less the kind of all the partisan sort of grandstanding kind of comes into play. Like at city council, a lot of times over the years, we've seen some unlikely alliances. Yeah. People just thinking, well, what are the practical implications for the people in my district or in this local community? And some of that political posturing sort of fades away. Mm-hmm. I think in school boards, it should be that way too. And it often has been that way, maybe not so much now, mm-hmm. where you're like, how are we going to make our schools operate as well as they can?
Right.
What are we going to do with the budget that we have? Who are the people that we're going to put in place to be able to really manage things well on behalf of the kids? And we were starting to see partisan politics really inject itself into NEIC. And I think you're right. I think that this was kind of a rejection of that. And the two PACs, you mentioned one of them, Parents United for Freedom. It was one, for those watching on YouTube, I've got a mailer from another one, Texas Family Action, and they had a slate of candidates. They had Rhonda Roland, Jack Hoyle, Chris Evans. And, on their mailer, they're talking about parents are the child's best advocate. I believe in that, but I also believe that we have to define what that means, because if saying parents' rights should be respected, does that mean if one parent calls and complains about a book, it's going to get taken out, so all the other parents in the district who maybe had no objection to it, their rights get thrown out?
Absolutely.
And that applies to everything, whether it's religion in school, the issue how race is discussed in classes. Some parents, are we going to let a few parents dictate for all the parents?
For all. Yeah. And the thing is that, and I think people who don't follow it, they don't really understand. But over the years, it has evolved and not on accident. I mean, on purpose. This has been a purposeful move to give parents more rights. So I do think in that way, for the parents that do feel like that they want more say in their child's education, they want to know, they want more transparency.
Sure.
They want, they don't want certain things taught. There are plenty of policies and protocols now to protect those parents and those kids from whatever boogeyman that they see that's out there. And then everybody else can have a normal education, and a standard education and not affect the whole school.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And so I just think that there's been a lot of misinformation as well. And I'm just so proud of voters for the ones that voted for understanding, for seeing through that and for choosing students. So we're putting students first, because this election really put the need to students first. And I think you're going to see that it's going to be positive changes there, but also just progress toward working with these problems. I mean, dealing with the $39 million budget shortfall, they need all of their attention on that.
Absolutely.
And it's not like the state of Texas is going to come over and say, well, here's a bag of money. You obviously need it. Because every district needs
it. The state of Texas kind of got them into it.
And to me, also, just on a generally, these results just gave me kind of, I don't know, optimism, gave me kind of hope for other elections. Like, oh my gosh, they saw this. Maybe this will continue happening.
Yeah. And because there was every reason to think, just driving around the district, seeing the signs for Jack Hoyle and some of the other cans that were favored by these PACs. And you just, when you have a low turnout election, I thought, well, it's possible just because people are seeing these names so frequently. Yeah. Sometimes you go in, you don't know too much about the candidates, and that can be a very powerful thing. But there were people who went in consciously saying, I'm rejecting that agenda.
And voices are definitely heard. Yep.
Well, we're on the subject of education. I wanted to wrap things up by talking about what's been going on in the college campuses and the protests that we've been seeing, the pro-Palestinian protests. And I mean, we could spend a few podcasts talking about this. So I don't think we're going to really be able to do the kind of deep dive that it requires. But I did want to talk about what's been happening. We've seen at the University of Texas, we've seen protests there. We've had people arrested.
The troopers. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's right. And so we've seen, you know, we've seen protests at college campuses across the country. Columbia has, you know, we've had students take over buildings, and it's gotten a lot of national attention. And I think, you know, the struggle has been to look at, define this in a way where we're accepting the idea that there is a strong tradition and a good positive tradition of student activism, student protest, and trying to balance that out with the need to also protect students who maybe are not involved in politics and want to just go to class and want to have an environment where the school can function. And then also the issue of anti-Semitism, which has popped up in certain places. I mean, I don't want to paint with a broad brush because there have been many protests where that has not been an issue. But there have been incidents or individuals who have been guilty of that. So in trying to make sense of it, I mean, when you look at what's been going on, I mean, what stands out to you?
I mean, to me, it kind of goes back to Greg Abbott. I keep thinking about he has this, during the first major UT protest last week, the first encounter we have with DPS, when they're, you know, invited onto campus, and that's when you had the first spate of arrests. There was a tweet from Governor Abbott that was just basically, this is what you get. You know, you engage in anti-Semitic protests, and this is the consequence of that. And it's he seems to be taking the idea, the concept of anti-Semitism, and just extending it, broadening it to a point where any pro-Palestinian protest is kind of on its face anti-Semitic. And I just think that's dangerous, and it's definitely demagogic.
Yeah,
you know, to pretend like, you know, concern about what's happening in Gaza equals anti-Semitism. I mean,
there's so many nuances there. I mean, it's really nuanced. Mm-hmm. Is there anti-Semitism? Yes. But is it all of it? Can you blame it all? And can you shut down First Amendment rights, you know, freedom of speech because of that? Yeah. Absolutely not. Right. And it's highly problematic. I am very concerned about, I just keep, and granted, I mean, I left journalism for a little while. I was a journalism teacher, but I taught junior high, little high school. And so I just keep thinking about those little babies covering the story, right? These young adults, right, in college who work for the newspapers at Columbia and UT Austin and UCLA and all the other ones. They are, I mean, you imagine this is the center of their universe. It's happening on their campus. This is their house, right? Yeah. This is their home. And they are covering it. And some of them are actually getting injured and arrested in the process. Mm-hmm. There was also a videographer from Fox in Austin who was he was assaulted, right? Mm-hmm. And we saw the video evidence of it. And, you know, and then of course DPS is saying, well, he injured, you know, he assaulted first and different things. But, you know, the press, whether you are a professional or you're in college, you are doing your job just like everyone is there. I know, I understand that they're trying to keep the peace, and I get that as well. You kind of picture as well the students, like you said, who are going to college, who are just going to school and don't want to deal with it. And you want to keep them safe. I talked during that weekend when all that happened. It was a friend of a friend, and they said, yeah, well, I know someone one that she was going, she's in high school, she was a senior, and they were doing a trip to, they went on a trip on a school bus to UT Austin for a college tour. And so they get there and they see this scene and said, nope. Yeah, and they packed the bus again and took off, right? Thank God for that. Because you don't want to be in the middle of it. And so I understand trying to keep the peace. But also, when you see that after they move DPS troopers out of there, out of, we're talking about Austin again, because that's the closest to home here. When they move them out, it was peaceful protests after that. And they have continued to go on. And what it did, having the troopers there, was it made things a lot worse, right?
Yeah, I think that's the thing that happened to UT specifically, and it's probably happened elsewhere, is that when you bring in, you know, DPS, when you bring in the law enforcement, you're sort of heightening the sort of tension in on the campus, and that one in UT at UT was really sort of, we're anticipating that there's going to be trouble. We're anticipating that there's going to be anti-Semitism. I mean, as you say, Greg, I mean, there really was no evidence of that happening. Yeah. And so they're creating this environment where you started to see students were actually, a lot of their attention was focused now on DPS and law enforcement and saying, we, you know, get off our campus. And so that really became the focus of a lot of the anger. And so, I think you're
They're angry. I think that is a key word. These kids, and I say kids, right? These young adults, they are angry. I don't think we've seen another group like this one. I think it is very unique for a lot of reasons. This moment is it's a watershed moment. It is unique for a lot of reasons. And we can't discount the effect of COVID and quarantine and all of that too. You have to think these kids lived through that. These kids lived through the drills, active shooter drills. They lived through their schools getting shot up and their classmates getting killed. All of those things are adding up to the anger that they feel, especially toward law enforcement. They don't trust them. They're angry. So when they see that, you know.
And there's been a buildup of, we've seen coming for years now, which is, I think among young progressive activists, seeing the sort of knee-jerk U.S. support for Israeli policies. Mm-hmm. Many of which have been, when we're dealing with Gaza in particular, have been really objectionable. And the U.S. in its sort of commitment to Israel, I think that we've seen, I think, a lot of people pushing back on that and resentment of that U.S. policy. And it's just been building and building for a while. And I think what we've seen with the war between Hamas and Israel and all of the Palestinian civilians who've been killed and wounded in recent months, I think it's just touched off something, like you said, that's just very, very, it's just really powerful anger. And I think the thing is, can we let people express themselves? And because when you bring in law enforcement, I mean, there may be situations where it's necessary, but when you bring in law enforcement into these environments, I think if it's coming because elected officials are wanting to make a show of force, they're wanting to show how tough they are.
Which was the impression I got the first day the DPS showed up in full riot gear.
Right.
And, they're just coming in, it's an army of them.
They have been there after that. They have.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. After not that. Like but that. I mean, right. Yeah. And I'm talking about their first appearance. Mm-hmm. Like that was a very powerful thing. And I think, I think there is something to, and this, it may be unique to Texas, mm-hmm. but DPS carries with it the stigma of Uvalde. And, that
absolutely,
there was, that first day there was a chant along the lines of, you failed Uvalde, but you're muscling your way into this situation. Can't remember what the chant
absolutely,
was.
Absolutely, yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, that may be unique, that kind of, I think, on a lot of college campuses, there's going to be some mistrust of law enforcement agencies. When it comes to DPS in Texas, I think it's got that little extra dimension, the failing of that police agency and, two dozen others at Robb Elementary.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to wrap things up. I hope everyone's doing well. We'll be back again with you next week. Take care.